What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Hey there, Sarah. Hey there, David. I mean, what do you think? We saw a little bit of a sell-off towards the close here, don't you think? That's part of what was happening today, was there was uncertainty about what was going to happen with both of these situations, and why would you go long into them?
So the headlines in the earlier afternoon didn't seem to shake the market, though you're right into the close. Art Cashin came by, as he always does, to the set to talk about the imbalance and the sentiment around the close. $2 billion to sell was a heavy amount. He did cite some nervousness and uncertainty into some of these headlines. But Mike Santoli brought up a point, which is some of the economic agenda that this market has liked, lower corporate taxes, deregulation, has already been put in place. So the question remains, what ultimately does it mean for the markets and for the economy when you have some uncertainty around the presidency?
Yeah. All right. Thank you, guys. Thank you, David. Thank you, Sarah. Now, let's get to Sue Herrera. She's got the latest on all the developments out of the Michael Cohen hearing and the Paul Manafort trial. Sue.
Indeed, Michelle. Thank you very much. Basically, here's the lowdown on what has happened this afternoon. Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer, pleading guilty to 8 criminal counts in Manhattan federal court earlier today, including 2 violations of campaign finance laws. Mr. Cohen, and this is the main headline that people are talking about at this point, says at the direction of the, quote, candidate for federal office, that would be the now President Trump, he arranged to make payments, quote, for the principal purpose of influencing the election. Basically, sentencing is going to be December 12th for Mr. Cohen. Bail was set at $500,000. Now, for Mr. Manafort, there were 18 counts against Paul Manafort, alleging a variety of misdeeds, including filing false taxes, failure to report foreign bank and financial accounts, and bank fraud. He was found guilty on all 5 false tax reports. And that carries a total maximum of 15 years. He was found guilty on count 12, which is failure to file reports of foreign bank and financial accounts. He faces 5 years on that maximum. The bank fraud, count 25, guilty, a maximum of 30 years. Count 27, bank fraud, guilty, maximum of 30 years. So the jury came out with a guilty verdict on 8 counts. 10 counts, they could not come to a consensus, and the judge has declared a mistrial. The judge has also given the attorneys, the prosecutors, about a month to decide whether they want to retry Mr. Manafort on those 10 remaining counts. So Mr. Cohen is going to do a plea deal. We don't know whether that plea deal includes his being forced to cooperate with prosecutors. That has not been revealed. Mr. Manafort basically faces up to close to 80 years in prison if he gets the maximum on all of those charges. We should note that the U.S. attorney is scheduled to speak in just a short while, and we will have those headlines for you as well. Michelle, back to you.
All right. Thank you, Sue Herrera, for running that down for us. And we're going to keep these live pictures up, the Manafort trial, Alexandria, Virginia, and the Cohen hearing in New York, because we expect attorneys to be departing the buildings. We're going to carry into the important news conferences live. In the meantime, let's trade what happened here. What do you guys think? Did we see a sell-off because this was happening and there was uncertainty about it?
We've had a lot of political uncertainty during this administration. Would you say that today is a new level of such? Certainly convictions for folks that are directly tied to the president are going to lead to a lot more speculation. Again, what is the Michael Cohen plea? How does that directly implicate the president? But bottom line here is markets, unless they believe certain things are going to be unwound, as was mentioned earlier, I think the biggest issue really is as you get into midterm elections where people want to impute some of this upon the ability, member of this administration, to control the House, the judiciary, and the executive branches. Those are the most important things for the market right now. And frankly, we've heard a lot of noise before.
So I think the market did sell off based on what we're hearing. When you saw those tapes, the lines coming across the tape, Cohen, everyone thought he was going to cooperate. And then you don't know if he's really going to cooperate, go against the president. So the market definitely sold off from that. But I think it's more about impeachment.
and whether he is susceptible to it.
Mm-hmm. So what does the midterm election look like? Is it possible to impeach him? So this is not about unwinding anything that's already been done. I think this is what is the future potential of this administration.
Carrie.
Right. I agree. I'm trying to think about, all right, what's left on the Trump agenda? Let's say he's not going to be able to do what's left on his agenda. To me, front and center, and it has been all summer, is trade. What is our trade policy going to be? Does this weaken him in his effort to try to be strong to China or to the EU? I'm not certain. I don't know. I think that
that would probably rally the market, though, in my opinion, if
he were to become softer on trade. Maybe, right. Maybe. I'm not really sure, although I think in general, I think a weakened president who's so pro-business is probably not a good thing for the market in the short term.
I think when you think about, like you guys just mentioned, the midterms, what does it really mean for that? Let's say the Dems take back the House. You're really de-risking this presidency. So in some ways, it's actually kind of like vol dampening, in my opinion. You know, we have a market, like you said, Tim, this whole administration, there's been lots of tape bombs. The market really hasn't cared until this last 6 months where we've been grinding around here. Now we're back to those prior highs. I think it's important to remember that as things have been heating up over the last month, the S&P has gone from 2,700 right. to 2,850. So the market participants have not really cared. And in my mind, if you were to see at least one house, okay, and you know, if you were to see one house in Congress go back to the Dems, you're basically taking a lot of risk out, because then you have to get to a standpoint where you have to compromise on things like that.
See, I get the theory behind that. Yeah. I think you're right. On some level, it allows you to, what has happened, and now we can kind of move on. And if you thought there was disorder before, now there's going to be order. I think the market's going to be totally opposite of that. I think if you actually saw a change in the House, markets would lose 5%. And I think markets should lose 5%. Because let's be clear.
Well, it has to be the opposite of what we've seen.
Yeah, I think this administration
is that they're going to push it whatever they want.
But if I could go back to your point about de-risking. All right, let's say he gets impeached by the House. Yeah. And you've got so many Democrats in there. The Democrats are even more anti-trade than a lot of Republicans. Like, I don't think trade gets softer at all. I mean, if Hillary Clinton had won, TPP wouldn't have happened, right? She would have become just as anti-trade.
I think the point is that the last 18 months, there's been no compromise any which way. And I think compromise might be viewed by market participants.
Well, you just said the market has done nothing but go up, though.
No, I understand. So listen, let's go back to the tariff stuff. I think President Trump said it himself. You know, the stock market's at all-time highs. So let's use some of that and renegotiate some of these trade deals. I don't think anybody disagrees with that thought process whatsoever. We are at all-time highs. You know, the S&P is up, you know, pushing up to high single digits on the year. That is some political capital you could use to do things. I just think a lot of people don't like the way it's been done.
Now, when you look at the SPY, the ETF that tracks the S&P 500, it's lower by about a third of a percent. Look, is that that much? Or is that, you know, it touched the highs today? Is it natural it would come back a little bit?
Right. Good point. If there was no news today, seeing us go up and test that 2873 level and give some ground back totally makes sense. I mean, let's face it. These are quiet markets. I think this has been a move without a whole lot of liquidity behind it. And I agree that I don't think anyone is getting terribly worked up here. I do think you have a dynamic here where Karen talked about the dynamic of trade and how this president, you know, whether he's strong or not. I think the president, if anything, has proven he will be more aggressive, even if the perception is that might be he's got a little bit less of a foundation underneath him, because that's how he rolls. And if anything, I think he's going to go dig harder into trade because I think he feels that's what he's supposed to do.
I think what you also have to not discount is the ability when you have tape reading algos. When you see a headline come out about Cohen plea deal, it immediately sells the market off. And not aggressively, but we see the intraday chart. The market did sell off on these headlines. Small, but it did sell off nonetheless.
I think the thing without even knowing exactly what it was, correct.
A couple things that were important to today's rally and have been important over the last couple of days is look at the dollar. So the dollar index has given back about 2% over the last couple of days. And we talked about this last night. We talk about it often on the show, that the dollar is a flight to quality. If that's what the trade is, it's usually not good for markets. When the dollar is selling off and we've been at our weakest points in the dollar in the last 18 months is when you've actually seen the global economy. Oh, we can actually rally it. Oh, all these other markets are interesting. Oh, even some of our own multinationals do better in this environment. So I think that the dollar continuing to weaken is something else that you have to watch. And let's face it, that's been also part of the dialogue. It's been the Fed, it's been the dollar, and what this administration wants. Right now, they're getting that. That's been very important for markets.
We had though some good earnings today. If we get back to the fundamentals, you know, we had Steve's been following the home builders for a long time. Those were some really good numbers today. We've had some really strong retail numbers. I think we have still a couple of weeks left of S&P earnings coming out.
Hold on. We're going to go take this live picture here. As you see, Michael Cohen coming out of the courthouse with his lawyers. Let's see if he's going to talk to the media at this point. He often does. Michael Cohen just entered a plea deal, not speaking with the press. His attorney trying to fight to get into the car here. As Sue Herrera told us earlier, probably the most consequential headline is that Cohen said at the direction of a candidate for federal office, he was told to make payments for the principal purpose of influencing elections. That is probably the key headline here, and the one headline that perhaps puts the president most at risk at this point. And no surprise you're going to see a big melee of reporters outside of lower Manhattan federal court. Let's bring in CNBC's editor-at-large in Washington, D.C., John Harwood, with more. John.
Michelle, I just wanted to add to the discussion you all were having about trade. President Trump has had a consistent pattern throughout his presidency. When he experiences adversity, he reinforces, doubles down, goes back at the things that he believes have been most successful in keeping his base loyal to him. So I think there's every reason to think at this point that his actions on trade, where he sees the ability to act unilaterally, imposing tariffs, negotiating, imposing other tariffs, or taking actions as using his executive authority, every reason to think he's going to do that even more intensely now than he has been doing it as he tries to demonstrate that he still has power and he can still do things. Obviously, everything will change, as you guys were discussing, if one House of Congress flips. The most forecasters believe that the House of Representatives is likely to flip. It's possible the Senate could flip, much less likely than the House. And so that creates the prospect that the administration will be consumed by investigations, potentially impeachment, that sort of thing. But I do think in the near term, you should expect the trade actions to get more intense rather than less.
Yeah, when he feels cornered or under pressure, John, he gets more
Absolutely.
Aggressive.
Yep.
And we're going to show this video one more time, John. I mean, this is really incredible, huh? I mean, what a turn of events for Michael Cohen, the man who used to be so defensive of President Trump and now turning on him. No details about exactly what he's going to do in terms of if he's going to testify or not against the president. But we're at a situation that is just unthinkable, what, a year ago.
Well, and Michelle, just to point out, he already has testified. In other words, he has said that he committed a felony at the behest of Donald Trump. Whether or not there's a cooperation agreement that summons more information or different information from him, that is plenty damaging on its own, that he has confessed to a crime that he said he committed at the direction of the president.
Absolutely. And I guess the key question is, let's bring in Ayman Javers, who's outside the White House with all the latest developments. Is Ayman, we're wondering if that's it or if there's more to come from Michael Cohen.
Well, Michelle, as you raise that issue, we're just getting a hard copy here of the Michael Cohen plea agreement, and I'm just scrolling through it in real time with you, looking at some of the details here in the agreement. One of the things that we're going to be looking for is whether Cohen has agreed to cooperate with investigators on an ongoing basis and what the details around that cooperation are. I'm just opening the document now, so we don't know if this document is silent on that piece of this or not. It's possible now that the document could be silent on Michael Cohen's potential cooperation, but there could be additional pieces to this, I am told by experts, that are filed under seal and so therefore are still secret. So it is the possible situation that we don't know all of the facts here that the Southern District of New York is aware of and that Michael Cohen is aware of. Some of this may still be under seal, so we're not necessarily looking at a complete set of facts, but according to the plea agreement, Michael Cohen here is pleading guilty to 8 counts here. What the agreement says is the total maximum term of imprisonment on counts 1 through 8 is 65 years. So a significant potential prison sentence for Michael Cohen, and that would, you would imagine, be a hefty incentive to cooperate.
Hold on, Ayman. We're going to go to Manafort's attorney, who's now speaking in Alexandria, Virginia.
He is evaluating all of his options at this point. Thank you, everyone.
All right, that was quick. Once again, Paul Manafort. If you're having trouble keeping the players straight, that was Paul Manafort's attorney at a separate trial down in Alexandria, Virginia, where he was found guilty of 8 counts. This is the former campaign manager for President Trump. Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, entered a plea agreement. Let's go back to Eamon Javers, and maybe he's had a chance to actually look at that document that's just all hit our desk as well to see if he's got any more details about what he might know about what Michael Cohen is willing to do.
Yeah, well, we don't know, and I'm literally reading this on live television right now, which is never a good way to do reporting.
Nope.
Struck there, though, by Kevin Downing, the attorney for Paul Manafort, we just saw coming out in Virginia saying that Manafort is considering all of his options. So the question is, does he have an appeal in mind, and what is the impact here on the jury being deadlocked on 10 of those counts that were brought against Paul Manafort? I mean, if you're Paul Manafort's lawyers here, this is, on the one hand, it's a devastating loss, but on the other hand, the jury was unable to come to consensus on more than half of the counts against your client. So you feel like you might have some kind of a leg to stand on here moving forward legally. So they're going to have some options there to consider. And clearly, you can see that they're going to weigh that and make a decision about how to proceed. Ultimately, though, it looks like Paul Manafort will be facing some potential jail time there in Virginia. Oh, Michael Cohen facing a significant amount of jail time in New York, and all of that incentive for Cohen and Manafort, presumably, to cooperate with any inquiries from the special counsel in terms of what they know about any interactions they had with President Trump. All of that has to make people here at the White House very, very nervous. It has to be infuriating to the president, who was outraged, as you remember, by both the raid on Michael Cohen's office and home.
Speaking in New York, we're going to interrupt you, Eamon. Let's listen.
New York office of the IRS. Also with me are the prosecutors from the United States Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York who prosecuted the Cohen matter. I'm going to have a brief statement and will not be taking any questions. Today, as you heard, Michael Cohen pled guilty to 8 felony charges. 5 of those dealt with tax evasion for the years 2012 through 2016, in which he failed to report approximately $4.1 million in reported income. Approximately 2.5 of that money was from interest payments from a personal loan that he failed to report. Approximately $1.3 million of that money was from the operation of his taxi medallion business. Approximately $100,000 of that money was from brokerage commissions, and over $200,000 was from consulting fees. That's over $4.3 million over a 5-year period, which translates into a loss to the United States Treasury of approximately $1.3 million. In addition, in count 6, Mr. Cohen pled guilty to making false statements to a financial institution in connection with an application for a home equity line of credit. In that application, he failed to disclose more than $14 million in debt that he had, and as a result of that concealment, he obtained that $500,000 line of credit, which he would not have been entitled to had he been candid and honest. In addition, Mr. Cohen pled guilty to 2 campaign finance charges, one for causing an unlawful corporate contribution, and a second one for personally making an excessive personal contribution, both for the purpose of influencing the 2016 election. In addition, what he did was he worked to pay money to silence 2 women who had information that he believed would be detrimental to the 2016 campaign and to the candidate and the campaign. In addition, Mr. Cohen sought reimbursement for that money by submitting invoices to the candidate's company, which were untrue and false. They indicated that the reimbursement was for services rendered for the year 2017, when in fact those invoices were a sham. He provided no legal services for the year 2017, and it was simply a means to obtain reimbursement for the unlawful campaign contribution. A couple of points I'd like to make. First, these are very serious charges and reflect a pattern of lies and dishonesty over an extended period of time. They are significant in their own rights. They are particularly significant when done by a lawyer who, through training and tradition, understands
what it means to be a lawyer, to engage in honest and fair dealing and adherence to the law. Mr. Cohen disregarded that training, disregarded that tradition, and decided that he was above the law, and for that he was going to pay a very, very serious price. With respect to the campaign finance violations, the campaign finance laws are designed to prevent the use of illegal money in elections and to maintain the integrity of those elections. Mr. Cohen made guilty pleas for those campaign violations, and those are core violations. And what he did was these pleas remind us that it is illegal for corporations to make contributions to candidates, and it is illegal to make contributions in excess of the amount that Congress set for individuals. That is a strong message today, and we will not be fear of prosecuting additional campaign finance cases. Lastly, and perhaps most importantly, this case is unique in many ways. Just witness the gathering of all of you here today. And in other ways, it's unique as well. But in the really important ways, this case is not unlike many cases that my office, the United States Attorney's Office, brings, that the entire Department of Justice brings, and that the law enforcement agencies do as well, including the FBI and the IRS. This case has more in common with all those cases because they all share the same message. And that message is that the rule of law applies, and that for law enforcement, all of whom are gathered here, it is our commitment that we will pursue and vindicate those who choose to break the law and vindicate the majority of people who live law-abiding lives, who follow honest and fair dealing, and live lives of lawful behavior. The message is that we are here, prosecutors are here, law enforcement is here, the Department of Justice is here, the law enforcement agencies here. We are a nation of laws, and the essence of this case is about is justice, and that is an equal playing field for all persons in the eyes of the law, and that is a lesson that Mr. Cohen learned today, and it is a very harsh one for him. Thank you very much.
Who is the candidate you're talking about?
I'm sorry. One other thing. I'm sorry. I'd also like to introduce, my fault. I really want to thank Mr. Sweeney and James Robnett of the FBI and the IRS and the agents who work for them. We do many, many cases with them, and their determination and their fair dealing and their vigor with which they pursue their cases is really inspirational. To the prosecutors in my office, I cannot express the gratitude for the hard work that they did in this case. And that is Assistant United States Attorneys Andrea Griswold and Nick Roos and Rachel Maiman and Tom McKay, as well as Ed Discant, the Deputy Chief of the Public Corruption Unit, and Russell Capone, the Chief of the Public Corruption Unit. For all of these people, I could go on and on about their many virtues and talents. But the one important thing is they all are satisfied with simply being known as public servants, prosecutors, and law enforcement agents who are doing their job. Thank you very much.
Can they tell us who your candidate is since you listed them?
U.S. Attorney Robert Khozami there in Lower Manhattan. If you're just tuning in, an incredible confluence of events. Two men, once very close to President Trump, within a space of 1 hour, have both either pled guilty or been found guilty of federal law. Both will be going to federal prison. For more, let's bring back in CNBC's editor-at-large in Washington, John Harwood. John.
You know, I think hearing from Robert Khozami saying we are a nation of laws is a reminder that for all of the sensation that we attach to things that President Trump says and the sort of spectacle around his presidency, you do, in fact, have the justice system moving forward. The Justice Department, that is part of the executive branch of the government. And President Trump has criticized Attorney General Sessions and put the word justice in quote marks when he's talking about the Justice Department. But that is the department staffed with serious people who are going to do their jobs. And it's notable that this particular guilty plea was obtained by Khozami who is not Robert Mueller. Remember, President Trump has been attacking Robert Mueller and what he calls the angry Democrats who work for him, even though they're not angry Democrats, but has been trying to undercut public support for the Mueller investigation. This is separate from that, although the matter may have been referred by Robert Mueller. This is a separate prosecutor. And the more different avenues of justice that are being pursued in this case that touch on President Trump makes it more difficult for him to undercut and discredit all of those efforts.
He'll speak tonight at 7 o'clock in West Virginia. We're going to see. John Harwood, thank you so much. Tim Seymour, what do you think? What do the markets do as a result of this tomorrow? Anything?
I tell you what, I think the markets, which went up and touched a high, as I said earlier, if we had done this on a day without this news, I still think the market might have been taking a breath tomorrow. So it's a market that has seen a process drag on for a long time. I care a lot more about what the Fed is doing. I care a lot more about these trade deals for the market. I care a lot more about earnings. I think in the short run, I think this market has taken a pause, but I don't think that the market is going to fall out of bed tomorrow.
The market knew Manafort was coming, right? I mean, we were waiting for a verdict. It was Cohen that was the unknown,
either of these
the
guys. Are we really
today,
that
right?
surprised?
Right. No,
well,
I just wondered
guys,
to what
Manafort
degree.
The Manafort thing is important because what his lawyer just said is he's considering all his options. So the thing is, if he's going to cut a deal, that means that he has to rat out somebody above him, and that really only leaves the president, his son, and his son-in-law. And so then it's just kind of tightening this web closer and closer. And that's really, I think, the tape bomb that's next. What's Manafort going to do, right? And then what is the president? This weekend he tweeted that he could get involved in the special counsel's investigation.
Right.
Are we going to have a Saturday Night Massacre? Those are the two tape bombs. The markets will care about those two.
Let's get to Sue Herrera in the newsroom. She's got the latest on the Manafort verdict. Sue.
Yeah, once again, just to recap, Michelle, a mistrial on 10 counts, guilty verdicts on 8. Just a few moments ago, we heard from Manafort's attorney, Mr. Downing. Here's what he had to say.
You may have heard that the jury reached a verdict on only 8 of the 18 counts. On 10 of those counts, they did not reach a verdict. Mr. Manafort is disappointed of not getting acquittals all the way through or a complete hung jury on all counts. However, he would like to thank Judge Ellis for granting him a fair trial, thank the jury for their very long and hard-fought deliberations. He is evaluating all of his options at this point. Thank you, everyone.
And now the question is, Michelle, do prosecutors go back and re-examine those 10 counts that resulted in a mistrial and decide whether or not to retry? Also, keep in mind, Mr. Manafort has a second trial on separate charges coming up in the middle of September. So he asked to have two separate trials. The speculation is that basically if he could get off on a number of the initial counts, that perhaps he might get a pardon from the president if he was found guilty. That was the speculation that was swirling around, and then maybe the second trial wouldn't happen. But he has been found guilty on 8 counts, and that second trial is scheduled to go forward in the middle of September. Back to you.
Yeah, we'll be watching that one, too. Thank you very much, Sue Herrera. Eamon Javers is outside the White House with the latest on all of these developments. And Eamon, the president tweeted out he is headed to West Virginia this evening, a place he is very comfortable in. He goes there frequently. Overwhelming support for him in that state. He's not going to change those plans as a result of this, right?
Look, I think that rally tonight is going to be extremely boisterous. The president's going to be facing a very friendly crowd. He is going to be fired up. You saw the stream of tweets from the president over the past several days about all of this. The president very much frustrated by the special counsel's investigation overall. And so I think you can see you can expect to see a very feisty President Trump in West Virginia tonight. One point that I want to just lay out for you that as we're going through these documents, we're learning more and more about Michael Cohen's plea. And an important piece of this is that in part of that excessive campaign contribution allegation here that Michael Cohen has now pled guilty to, he's saying that he paid a woman $130,000 from a company under his control in coordination with and at the direction of the presidential candidate in October of 2016. Remember, President Trump denied knowing anything about the payments to Stormy Daniels in that time frame. The former porn star, the I guess current porn star and stripper, Stormy Daniels. So this is saying very clearly that this payment was made in coordination with and at the direction of the candidate for president, that is Donald Trump. This is Michael Cohen pleading guilty in a federal document saying that Trump knew about that and directed that payment. This is astonishing stuff, and it's going to be a dramatic moment here for the president tonight as he tries to recover his political footing and put the best face on all of this. This is dramatic and politically damaging, and you can't imagine many other presidents being able to take on this much political water. But this president, to John's point, has been able to do that so far and survive politically.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It will be boisterous tonight. But porn star, so judgmental, Amy. Adult film actress.
Right.
How about that?
All however, right. However you want to put it.
Amy Javers, live at the White House. We going to Tony Dwyer, who's just sat down as a Thea? Tony Dwyer is joining us on the set. What do you think the market does with this? Does this matter to the market?
It'll matter very short term. Michelle, I'm kind of with Tim, I think, and Karen. I think what you have to do is look at what really drives the market over time. President Clinton was impeached the end of 1998. That wasn't the peak of the tape. President Nixon was impeached in 1974, or wasn't impeached, but resigned in 1974. That was the low of the tape. So it
actually
depends on what
Tony, it actually wasn't low. So, I mean, if you look,
the S&P
500
year,
in January
right,
of 1973
right,
traded at an all-time high of 120. Okay?
Who cares about
that? Can I ask a basic question?
It kept going down.
Tony,
like I said,
people,
it was going
50%
up.
Hold on one second. People are going to tune in right now. They're going to see that intraday chart. They're going to know that all this news started to break late in the day. What do you draw from that chart? The chart sold off because of what was happening this afternoon? Or do you say, it's off by a third of a percent? It's shrugging off what happened today.
Points. Yeah, both are true. It did sell off because of that, but that's a pretty modest sell-off. Very modest, actually. I think that probably a lot of people thinking, you know what, if the market really gaps down a lot, I'd love to step in and buy. I think there's a lot of money still.
Credit is in really good shape. I mean, ultimately, the market moves with credit, with direction of earnings, which is driven by economic activity, which is driven by the availability of credit. So last Friday, I'm on the phone with a bunch of clients, and I asked them two very simple questions. Everybody's worried about liquidity, you know, a shutting down of liquidity to spend. I asked every portfolio manager I've talked to, are you hearing from your companies that business is slowing dramatically? And the answer was universally no. Are you hearing that they're having trouble accessing capital? And the answer was universally no. So educationally and academically, there's a liquidity shutdown. It's obviously showing up in Turkey and Tim's expertise in some of the emerging economies. It is not showing up here yet. It will. This is going to end badly. I don't think Dan
this
and I are on
the
opposite
side of the trade.
This
market is
going to
end badly, or this politics are going to end
no,
badly?
No, this is going to hit, take a hit.
Okay. So, so Tony, let me ask you a question.
Take a hit. It's what do you do with
Tony,
it? And Karen answered the question.
Tony, so when you say it's going to end poorly, so when I look at the United States outperforming the emerging markets, is it going to be where the emerging markets now, we flip-flop, and now the emerging markets rally, or do the United States catch up to the downside of the emerging markets?
So that's the question. The only way to answer it is, what is the ECB and Bank of Japan going to do? Now, it's no surprise that you've had mixed performance in the emerging economies. We've talked about it on the show, because you don't have every global central bank pumping money into the system. If every central bank is printing money, of course you want to go to the riskiest place with the most growth possible. When 24% of the global GDP, the U.S., is tightening monetary policy, it's a lot more of a mixed picture. So we're very neutral. We did it on the show in the very beginning of the year. We're very neutral on emerging over developed. But here's a newsflash. If you look at the European Citigroup European Economic Surprise Indices, it's actually trending
a little bit higher.
Let's
get to Sue Herrera in the newsroom, who has a statement from the aforementioned adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Sue.
Indeed, I do. And this statement is from her and also her attorney, Michael Avenatti. And here it is. This is the statement she gave to NBC News. Quote, Michael and I are vindicated, and we look forward to the apologies from the people who claimed we were wrong, end quote. And for those who don't know, Mr. Cohen's guilty plea today included an admission that he violated campaign finance laws by paying $130,000 to Stephanie Clifford, otherwise known as Stormy Daniels, a month before the election. So Michelle, back to you.
And he said he did it at the direction of a candidate.
Of a candidate, yep. Indeed. And, of course, the president has denied repeatedly knowing about that particular payment.
Thank you. Sue Herrera, mm-hmm. who's at the breaking news desk for us, as more of these details
Thank goodness,
come out.
Michelle, can I want to clarify something, because Dan's really right, and I'm about data integrity of data. The difference between 1974, you had a 50% decline in 1973 to 74. It was about the shutdown of credit, high inflation, high interest rates. It was 1974 that was a low year, so Dan's correct on that. However, 1998, didn't have a shutdown
of
credit.
Okay, but I just want to say
something.
Very
good
but this
time.
Is really important. In January of 1973...
Hold on, I want to tell people what we're looking at. I assume this is President Trump. Either is he taking off or is he landing in West Virginia? Okay, so he's got a... You talking to me? Go ahead. He's landed in West Virginia. He's going to go on his rally tonight. We'll watch for him to emerge from the plane. Oftentimes, he comes out and talks to reporters who are on the tarmac.
It was like your De Niro imitation. Are you talking to me?
He's talking to me. Dan Nathan, right, finish your thought about 1974.
And I'll tweet this out. Okay, in January 1973, the stock market was at an all-time high. Okay,
correct.
And then things really started to unfold, right, in 1974. But by the time, in October of 1973, when he fired the special counsel, this is President Nixon, the S&P was at 110, so down from 120. It went down over the next 6 weeks. It went down to 90. That's a significant move. So you can talk about inflation. You can talk about whatever. And you know where it bottomed out in 1974, six months after his impeachment and his resignation?
But credit was
63.
Shut down, Dan. You were in a recession.
But Tony, we were nothing. In January 1973, the stock market was discounting every piece of bad news that we saw over the next 18 months.
Do you think that President Trump is integral to this market? Because I don't. I think when we elected President Trump, there was a lot of people that felt we needed to deregulate a lot of parts of the market and parts of the global economy.
Isn't this about confidence in institutions? And what is the most important institution that people vote with their wallets all the time?
We're talking about the market. What does the market care the most about? The market cares most about an environment that's business friendly. That won't change if Trump leaves office. Bottom line is, I think
But he did put those in place, so you're right. So all the things that he enacted.
That's not going to change.
That was elected by the people. I mean, you have to assume.
People got tired of a pendulum
that had gone too far
in the
other direction.
Guys, we can sit here and argue about it. I'm just telling you what happened in 1973 and 1974 from an all-time high. That's all I'm telling you.
But, Dan, you're right. We have to examine, are we in that environment now? Forget the president. Are we in that environment now? And that case is no, but I understand your point.
But I don't think if that's what existed in January of 1973, they would have had a bunch of dummies like us sitting on there and saying how rosy everything was. And we were going to go.
I
wouldn't have been on that show, Dan.
My point is that do you think that banks are suddenly going to have a target back on their backs? Do you suddenly think that it's going to be a lot harder for small businesses to get loans? Do you think that the tax rate's going to suddenly
go higher? Don't even go that far. It's just the economic environment right now is not equivalent to the economic environment back then.
Again, driven by inflation, which drove the Fed to intentionally invert the curve and ultimately shut down availability of money. If businesses and households cannot have access to capital, they're going to stop spending and they're going to cut back.
On that point, Tony,
we are opposite of that right now.
You talked about businesses say they got plenty of access to capital, they got a lot of demand. Do they have access to labor? I mean, isn't that the big risk here, inflation? And wouldn't that be driven by labor?
Because we're having over 20% growth in the S&P 500, according to David Aurelio at Thomson Reuters, we're getting over 20% capital spending growth to offset the labor inflation. It's called the productivity trade we've talked about on the desk. You have a ramp in productivity because you don't have access to labor.
So you invest in machines, robotics, et cetera, because you don't have people
profit
to hire.
Non-financial profit margins in the S&P 500 are at a record high. 2 years ago, everybody was fearing that they were going to collapse. But that's with the increased cost. So there's productivity.
Is that CapEx enough to keep wage inflation lower? Because
average hourly earnings are saying yes. And
more importantly, the inflation
breakevens are saying yes.
From Air Force One in West Virginia as he heads to a rally in Charlottesville, West Virginia. Let's listen. Thus far, President Trump ignoring questions from the media. Let's see. He's often tempted to talk to the press, regardless of the situation.
As he thanks
of this welcome that he's getting from members of the military on the ground.
Any reaction? Any
reaction? I feel badly. I must tell you that Paul Manafort's a good man. He was with Ronald Reagan. He was with a lot of different people over the years, and I feel very sad about that. It doesn't involve me, but I still feel, you know, it's a very sad thing that happened. This has nothing to do with Russian collusion. This started as Russian collusion. This has absolutely nothing to do. This is a witch hunt, and it's a disgrace. But this has nothing to do with what they started out looking for Russians involved in our campaign. There were none. I feel very badly for Paul Manafort. Again, he worked for Bob Dole. He worked for Ronald Reagan. He worked for many, many people. And this is the way it ends up. And it was not the original mission, believe me. It was something very much different. So had nothing to do with Russian collusion. We continue the witch hunt. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, what about Michael Cohen? Any comment on Michael Cohen?
All right, President Trump walking away after taking those, speaking to reporters there, saying, I feel very bad for Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort was a good man. It doesn't involve me. It has nothing to do with Russian collusion. This is a witch hunt. You'll notice he was silent on Michael Cohen. He spoke only about Paul Manafort as he arrived there in West Virginia.
Well, look, bottom line is, you know, what we heard from Kazami earlier, I mean, this is a nation of laws. I mean, these are senior folks, at least, that were involved in this campaign, people that he's been associated with. Michael Cohen said he'd take a bullet for the president. And let's face it, these guys are dirty. And this is what we found out. So he feels bad for him, but he's trying to disassociate himself with him and attach him to other politicians. You know, bottom line is, I don't think this, you know, prints well on the president. But, you know, from a markets perspective, again, I would go back to, I think we're not terribly far from where we were before we got this news.
Let's bring back in CNBC's editor-at-large in Washington, John Harwood. You're not surprised by the president's response as he came off the plane, are you, John?
Well, I'm a little surprised that he would come over and take questions at all, but that if he did so, he would only speak to Manafort rather than Cohen. It's obvious the calculation there, because he points to Manafort, ties him to Reagan, and says that the charges didn't have anything to do with Russia. But remember, Paul Manafort was in that Trump Tower meeting. He is now under increased pressure. What will he subsequently cooperate with the special counsel? The president doubled down, said it's a witch hunt. There is no reason to think that it's a witch hunt. And, you know, he's playing his hand as best he can, but it's not a very good hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Paul Manafort was definitely in that meeting with the Russian lawyer, but the trial was very much about things he did while he worked for Viktor Yanukovych,
yes,
who was a Russian puppet. I mean, these are very, very old events relative to the campaign.
That's right. And there was an investigation of Paul Manafort that predated the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the actions that Paul Manafort is charged with, the financial crimes that he's charged with, did, in fact, occur while he was head of the campaign. But they didn't relate to the campaign. They related to him. Remember, Paul Manafort was in financial distress when he accepted the no-pay job as chairman of the Trump campaign. And we've seen from some of the evidence that has come out that he hoped to use that position to alleviate some of his financial distress. Communicated with one of his aides, said, how could we use the press I'm getting to get whole with his Russian oligarch, Oleg Deripaska, who he had been close to? So there is a nexus to the campaign and to Russia, but just not in these criminal charges. I got to say one thing, though, about your discussion on set. I agree. There's nothing that changes economic fundamentals about this. And the tax cut is passed. I think that's much more consequential than to corporate America than the regulation so far, because a lot of the regulation hadn't really done all that much. He was suspending things that Obama had planned, but hadn't really taken effect. But I don't think this is a barrier-smashing event for the economy itself. And if the president's ultimately forced from office and Mike Pence becomes president for the rest of this term, I don't see how that has a dramatic effect on the American economy unless you, it just depends on how you guys value the whole uncertainty issue. And I've never known exactly how to value what's uncertainty and what isn't, since nothing in life is certain.
That's why we have you cover politics and
economics.
So look, we're a long way from President Trump being forced from office, but
yes.
I want to tease that out a little bit. What would the market do, Tony Dwyer, if we had a President Pence instead of a President Trump? Would it go down or would it go up?
It will follow the direction of earnings ultimately, no matter who's in the White House. That's why Republicans or Democrats alike, if the economy's in a positive trajectory and earnings are in a positive trajectory, that's what the viewers should focus on. This stuff, we've been very clear. This is going to be high volatility going forward. It's not whether you can have market pullbacks. What do you do with them? And in a positive credit, positive economy, you buy them.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, would a President Pence be more predictable, less uncertain?
Yes. But
would that lead to a rally?
He might get less done.
A Pence would not get reelected, I don't think. President Trump is far more charismatic to his base. Right? To me, I mean, he's got to be the front runner at the moment. The Democrats are sort of in disarray. Pence, I don't think, has anywhere near the charisma that Trump does to his base. So I don't think he would be reelected. And if you see a blowback then and everything goes to the Democrats, House, the Senate, and the presidency, then we're in a very different market.
I agree with that, Karen. And there's been nothing about this president's volatile personality and actions that have dented the stock market. And this is a president that has gotten a fair amount done. And again, maybe it's circumstance. He was elected with a mandate because this is what this country wanted from the economy. I'm not sure this is what they wanted from the man. But I think this is what people
what
were voting for.
What mandate did he have? He lost the popular vote.
But when you look geographically,
not much of a mandate.
If you're just joining us, President Trump just landed in West Virginia moments ago, offered his first comment since Manafort was found guilty and Cohen pled guilty. Here's what he had to say.
I feel badly for both. I must tell you that Paul Manafort's a good man. He was with Ronald Reagan. He was with a lot of different people over the years, and I feel very sad about that. It doesn't involve me, but I still feel, it's a very sad thing that happens. This has nothing to do with Russian collusion. This started as Russian collusion. This has absolutely nothing to do. This is a witch hunt, and it's a disgrace. But this has nothing to do what they started out looking for Russians involved in our campaign. There were none. I feel very badly for Paul Manafort. Again, he worked for Bob Dole. He worked for Ronald Reagan. He worked for many, many people. And this is the way it ends up. And it was not the original mission, believe me. It was something very much different. So had nothing to do with Russian collusion. We continue the witch hunt. Thank you very much.
President Trump in West Virginia. Let's get back to Eamon Javers. He's at the White House. Eamon.
Yeah, Michelle, that's right. The president there clearly frustrated with what he's seen today and all these developments across the board, saying that he feels badly for Paul Manafort, but not answering there the key political question here and perhaps the key legal question is the president going to offer a pardon to any of the people who were involved today, to Michael Cohen or to Paul Manafort? The president has that option in his hip pocket if he should choose to use it. Not clear what the president's thinking is on that right now. And I can tell you that there are some intense meetings going on here in the West Wing. I was just inside the White House a few moments ago, spotted General Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, in meeting with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House Press Secretary. I asked General Kelly for his reaction on today's events. He simply walked by, didn't say anything at all. Sarah Huckabee Sanders said she doesn't have any comment, referred back to the president who just spoke. So the White House buttoning it up here, really, in terms of the staff and aides remaining at the White House, the president doing the speaking for all of them there in West Virginia.
So Paul Manafort didn't cooperate. We know that. We don't know for sure about Michael Cohen. If we discover that he is not cooperating, you could surmise maybe they're thinking exactly that, Eamon, right? That they wait for a pardon from the president.
Well, that's the thing about this case that's so unlike all of the white-collar cases that we've covered in years past, right? None of those defendants in all the different Wall Street cases and other things really had a realistic option of holding out for a presidential pardon. That element is alive in these cases. And so it stretches the different sort of theories of the case for the defense in terms of how you handle all of this. You know, you saw Manafort's lawyer there, Kevin Downing, suggesting that he's going to weigh all of his options. And one of his options is to hold out for a pardon.
Hey, Eamon, does it really matter in the Cohen case if he were to get a pardon? At this point, the feds already have all the documentation. They have all the recordings. They have a bunch of his testimony over the last couple months. I mean, go ahead. Give him a pardon. At that point, he actually can't plead the fifth, and he actually has to answer everything that the special counsel asks him.
Well, it's a great question, and at this point, you're right. Investigators do have all that material that they gathered from the raid on his office and the place where he was staying in the hotel room. So they have a lot of information from Michael Cohen. And it may be the case that as prosecutors think here about a future case of some significance, do you want, if you're the prosecution, to put Michael Cohen on the stand as a witness in any case? Given his unique personality, history, and set of circumstances, Michael Cohen might not be the most savory witness in front of a jury at some point down the line. So you might want his documents, you might want his recordings, his evidence, but you might not necessarily want Michael Cohen himself sitting on the stand talking to a jury.
Incredible turn of events, isn't it, Eamon? When we watch, we've been showing this video over and over again of Michael Cohen walking out of court. You know, the man who said that he would do anything for President Trump now coming to this. And what an irony, in the same hour almost as Paul Manafort, two men so close to the president, both facing the fact that they're going to go to federal prison.
Yeah, I mean, here's a guy in Michael Cohen who said he would take a bullet for President Trump. Then, just within the past couple of weeks, he's saying, no, he's not going to take a bullet for Donald Trump. His first loyalty is really to his family and to his country. That shift in Michael Cohen's loyalty was just a dramatic interpersonal moment for a guy who's really built his career at the hip of President Trump and engaging, according to what he pled guilty to, in some of the most unsavory dealings surrounding that presidential campaign in terms of allegedly paying off women for their silence, some of the things that were Donald Trump's most deepest, darkest, apparently, secrets during the course of the campaign.
You don't have to say allegedly anymore, Eamon.
Well, that's right. I mean, moving just target all day. Right. We've been doing this for 12 hours today, so where we are in the day is slipping a little bit. But right, that's the point. This is now a matter of record. He's pled guilty, and that is significant, and it's damaging to the president. The White House is going to have to respond to that in some way, and you can see the staff here working hard to come up with what their response is going to be, and you see the president already signaling that he is ready to fight.
Thank you. Eamon Javers, live at the White House.
This is all about the midterm elections at this point. What perception does this carry going forward in the next couple of months? How does that jockey for the midterms? This is a play for the midterms right now. The midterms hold the key for the rest of the market, and it's not the economy.
So what if the House turns? What if the House, let's say that's a given.
Yeah, it's a problem. The Senate is less likely than the House, and I guess the House, what does the House need? 24, whatever that number is. It's a problem, right? I don't know what it really means to the market. I think the market stays on track. To Tony Dwyer's point, earnings okay, market okay. I think this is just something we don't remember in a couple of days.
Does this reduce the turnout of his base in any way?
No, his base is solid. You can't. There's one side, there's the other side. You're not going to shake them. There's the people in the middle. Maybe you're possibly take them. But this was about middle America that took this election.
Let's ask that question to John Harwood. John Harwood, we're talking about what this means for the midterm elections. What does President Trump's base, are they less interested in coming out because of these convictions and plea agreements?
Yes. Bad news like this is always depressive for the side that's receiving the bad news. We've already seen for months now that Democrats have shown a much higher level of engagement and enthusiasm in the election. This will exacerbate that condition, that disparity between Democrats and Republicans, because Republicans are looking at circumstances surrounding the president, and even if they like the president, they see nothing but bad stuff going on. Democrats are invigorated by the idea of change, and so this is there's no question that this is going to be a help to the Democratic campaign, which, as we've been discussing throughout the hour, appears likely to flip the House from Republican to Democrat and could also flip the Senate. Less likely, there are a lot of seats in Trump-friendly states But many those seats are held by Democratic incumbents who usually have some skills or there wouldn't be incumbents. And there are enough possibilities out there for Democrats that it's not inconceivable that they could win both chambers. So if this is all about the midterms, this was a bad day for President Trump and for his party.
All right, John, thank you. Let's get to Sue Herrera in the newsroom, who's got more reaction coming in from a variety of people. Sue.
Absolutely. This one from U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut. He says, quote, "The White House looks increasingly like a criminal enterprise with the convictions today of President Trump's former campaign manager and personal lawyer." Basically, he also says, quote, "No one is above the law. The special counsel is for real, not a witch hunt." And in relationship to the discussion of a possible pardon, here's what he says. "For the loose talk about a possible pardon should end now. For the president to pardon either of these individuals would be reprehensible and irresponsible, an abuse of power, and possible obstruction of justice." We expect more comments from both sides of the aisle on this, and when we get them, we will give them to you. Mark Warner is weighing in. Basically,
I'll bet he's not happy either.
Here it is.
What do you think?
Quote, "This verdict makes it absolutely clear that the Mueller probe is not a witch hunt. It is a serious investigation that is rooting out corruption and Russian influence on our political system at the highest levels." I'm just reading it for the first time. So basically, that's the gist of it. He's repeating what Mr. Blumenthal said, which is, this is not a witch hunt by the special counsel, and it will continue.
I think the responses are going to be pretty
predictable. Were there no Republicans available for comment?
I doubt there's someone.
I think you're right, Michelle.
Right now. Thank you, Sue Herrera. All right. Does anybody do anything defensive tomorrow or no?
Just looking. I mean, Alphabet, I see, is down like $6. That's not enough for me to do anything.
Look,
but
market's overbought.
Here's where we are. I think we framed it pretty well. Bottom line is, real interest rates are negative in this country. The Fed needs to do something. The Fed's going to continue to do something. Stocks have tremendous earnings, and there's a tremendous economic backdrop. But we have valuations that probably, if you look at price to sales or even EV/EBITDA, you know, we're at bubblicious levels on a lot of the different valuation metrics. The market's at all-time highs. Is it time to go 2 feet in? For me, I don't think with this news you changed anything that you were going to do tomorrow.
Stocks are expensive or no?
No.
Depends on the stocks. It's not a monolith, right?
No, but I mean, I don't know. But when you talk about the forward earnings on the S&P 500,
no. Well, right, if you look at banks, like a J.P. Morgan or something like that, the big money center banks are not expensive to me. Even
they're cheap.
Like Alphabet.
Airlines.
Expensive.
I mean,
airline operating profits.
I'm long, though. So if I stay long, it's the same. I always think that's the same as buying.
Absolutely.
If I stay long.
Right. You're at 19 times earnings as you were in December of 2016, well before the tax cuts happened. You're at 19 times trailing 12 earnings today. There's got to be some kind of economic Armageddon to make my 160 number for the end of this year wrong. So you've had 19 multiple on both sides. Is this going to compress the multiple with 20% earnings growth over the next two quarters to 17 times? And when you have core inflation between 1 and 3%, which it currently is at 1.9 on the core PCE, market trades at 19 times. So I'm not...
Would you agree that in other Fed hiking cycles, the market multiple is contracting regardless of how strong earnings are? Obviously, if earnings are growing 20%+, and I don't think we're going to do that in perpetuity. There's a sugar high. Let's be clear. There's a sugar high from the tax cuts that we front loaded a lot of growth. And I think that's something to think about. But again, we have inflation. We have negative rates in this country, negative real rates. Whatever you want to believe, PCE doesn't measure it. We're hearing it from every company. They're having trouble filling jobs. They're having trouble paying people, or they can pay people. Well, but ultimately, that's going to feed through.
Well, let's look at what drives the country. Small business. NFIB Small Business Optimism Index hit a near record level and the highest level of this cycle. Your median period between a cycle high in the NFIB optimism and a recession is 41 months. So I totally agree with Tim. My problem isn't that this is going to go on forever. It's definitely going to end badly. You cannot fix debt with exponentially more debt and then make it expensive. But what you need to do is have a negative economy.
Statement coming in from people who work for President Trump. Let's bring in Ayman Javers. He's got more reaction at the White House. Ayman.
Yeah, that's right, Michelle. And a couple of things moving here at the same time. The White House now reacting to a new story. This from the Washington Post. The report is Trump advisor Larry Kudlow hosted publisher of White Nationalists at his home. A very tough headline there for Larry Kudlow. The Washington Post reporting that the publisher of a website that serves as a platform for white nationalism was a guest last weekend at the home of President Trump's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow. I can tell you that I just hung up the phone with Larry Kudlow a couple of seconds ago, and he told me this. He said, "I am disappointed and saddened to learn of these viewpoints and activities, and if I had known of any of that, I would never have invited him. I don't agree with any of it, none of it. I am a Jack Kemp civil rights Republican and always will be." So Larry Kudlow here denying that he had any awareness of the viewpoints of this particular person mentioned in this Washington Post story, but a damaging headline here for Larry Kudlow. Larry Kudlow saying he was completely unaware of these views. Michelle?
All right. That's a tough one. Thank you very much. Eamon Javers at the White House. Any market impact of that one?
No.
I mean, only if you thought Larry was at risk for any reason, right? I mean, Larry, I think, is very important. Larry's the guy behind no tariffs, no tariffs, no barriers, no subsidies. I'm tired. which is a very
Is he behind those things? Because
absolutely.
I think that he got, embraced full-throated Navarro. What are you talking about?
I think he's stayed pretty pragmatic about this whole thing.
Look, I respect a guy that just stepped in there and actually said, this is what I stand for. And I thought that was very clear.
I think he's been very clear. He's totally embraced the president's position on trade.
He's definitely soft.
All right. It's been an incredibly dramatic Fast Money. Thanks so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure
to
be here.
Thank you, MCC. Congratulations to you. Exciting and sad, but you've been unbelievably professional.
Thank you. Mad Money with Jim Cramer right now.
The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.